Welcome to the Liberty Podcast. We're so excited that you're interested in the teaching ministry of Liberty Bible Church. We're a multi-site church that exists to share the love of Christ across Northwest Indiana. If you're looking for a church home, please check us out at our website, findliberty.net. Thanks again for joining us as together we're transformed by the teaching from the Word of God.
Oh, well, before I jump into that text, let me pray over us. Father, as we just sang, and Psalm 23 says it as well, it is your goodness and mercy that is following after us all the days of our lives. You're not chasing us down to punish us, to threaten us. You have goodness and mercy for us. Help us to stop running, slow down, and receive it. Now by your word, in Jesus' name, amen. When people encountered Jesus in the Gospels, the dramatic followed. Zacchaeus, a man of greed, so hated in his hometown, he had to climb a tree just to get a glimpse of Jesus. Got that glimpse, and overnight gave over half of his income away. The dramatic followed. The woman at the well in John 4, probably there in midday hiding from her past and shame, but then encountered Jesus and became the first missionary in the Gospel of John, saying to her town, come meet the man who told me everything I ever did. And it was good news because she no longer had to hide in shame forever, but was free. She encountered Jesus, the dramatic followed, or Mary at Bethany, who encountered Jesus and decided to anoint his body with a perfume that was worth a year's worth of income. Just think about that. The average household income in Porter County is about $80,000. Imagine that. Someone who encounters Jesus and in one moment wants to pour out that type of generosity onto him. Or in Acts, you read on, so many people became Christians, encountered salvation of Jesus and radically changed. So many people became Christians that in Acts 17 in the city of Thessalonica, the non-Christians were freaking out. And they said this about the Christian, these men, these people who have turned the world upside down have come here also. The followers of Jesus turned the world upside down. Outrageous changes of life and character, generous acts of love, courageous financial generosity, so that the world was being shaken to its core by the Christians. So here's my question. What happened? In the words of Pastor John Tyson, when people think of Jesus in the church today, they think of a beige, passionless institution that somehow managed to take this man who has shaken history and make him boring. What happens? We go to a Notre Dame football game and the whole day's blocked out because we're gonna tailgate, paint our chests, scream for 4 hours, passion and joy. Then we come to church and it's like, shh, dial it back. We go to work Monday with dreams and vision about what we want to do and accomplish in the world. And we come to church where we argue about things nobody else cares about. We spend hours carting our kids off to practice for sports, music, school, because we love seeing the passion in life welling up in them. Who will they become? And we'll drive them anywhere to help them become that. Why? Because we human beings, we desire, we long, we love. And living in this world is supposed to be living with passion. But often the church becomes instead a passionless, boring place that speaks irrelevant things as the world moves on without Jesus and his church. And I'm just saying this morning, I don't want to be that kind of church. Did you hear Jesus' own words? I have come that they, my disciples, may have life. And have it abundantly, have it to the full. I have come that human beings be fully alive once again. That's what he's saying, life to the full. And I want to be a church that actually believes Jesus is right about this statement. And we pursue it with all our hearts. So here's what we're going to talk about this morning. Three things. The promise, the threat to the promise, and then how to be fully alive. So first, the promise. So Jesus says, listen to my voice, and you will have life to the full. And this is not a one-off statement. This is a statement that runs what I think is the major theme through the Gospel of John. This idea that Jesus has life for you, that is the central theme of the Gospel of John. So the very beginning of his Gospel, throughout John's Gospel, he'll have various stories where he says, this was a sign about Jesus. This word sign is really important in the Gospel of John, and a lot of commentators believe there's seven signs that go throughout the Gospel of John that prove Jesus is the Messiah and he has life in his name. Seven signs. And do you know what the first sign of Jesus was? He turns water into wine. What good does that do? Why did he do that? All it meant was that a wedding would not end early. That's the first sign of the Messiah in John's Gospel. There's a party that's going to end early, and Jesus says, no, it won't. And this is not a magic trick to John. Like, look at the cool thing Jesus did. John says this is a sign about who Jesus really is. But it's not just that he makes wine. He makes wine so good that the master of the feast stops everything he's doing, goes to the proper person, is like, why did you hold the best back till now? John 2, chapter 10, this is what is said by the master of the feast when he tastes Jesus' wine. Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now. How often do you think of Jesus as the master of the party? The greatest winemaker in history. My favorite moment in my Bible college education. We did this passage, and our teacher, what he did, he's illustrated. Because Jesus filled up seven jars first, and then he says, now go draw some out. And the whole point of the illustration was his belief and my belief. Jesus didn't turn the seven jars into wine. He turned the well into wine. An unending earth of the best wine possible. That's my own fun. You can take that or leave that. My point, this is not just a magic trick. Verse 11, what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. The party not ending earlier, creating the best wine, was a sign that Jesus is the Messiah. Just sit in that. How many churches have a reputation for throwing great parties? No, man, like growing up, it was the opposite. Hey, you're like, you have too much partying going on. You need to go to church and dial it all down. Stop having parties. That's what church is for. And listen, I get it. We don't know how to truly celebrate as human beings, and we take that in all kinds of terrible directions. But Jesus is not saying, your passions are all bad, dial it back. He's saying, you don't know how to party. Come meet the master of the feast, taste my wine instead. That's what John's saying in John chapter 2. It's his first sign. You read on in the Gospels of John, or Gospel of John, and you get to John 6, and Jesus says this statement: I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. Do you hear what he's saying? He's saying to you, I will fulfill every desire you've ever had. Eat from my table, you're not hungry anymore. Drink from my well, you're not thirsty anymore. And I don't know which is crazy, that Jesus, imagine like out in life this week and someone comes up to you and is like, hey, what do you desire? Only I can fulfill it for you. Like, we'd be disturbed by that person. But Jesus said this. And it's not just that he said this. Then his disciple John recorded it for us to say to us, I took Jesus up on his offer. It's true. I ate the bread. I drank the wine. I'm filled, John says to us by repeating these words. This is not beige, passionless, arguing about pointless things religion. John is saying, my passion for life, my desires, my life was met in Jesus Christ. And if you think I'm still stretching this too far, go to the end of the Gospel of John, one final example where John says why he's writing this book to us. John 20, verse 30. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. John said, do you want to really live? Do you want to have life? Do you want to be fully alive as a human being? It's Jesus. That's it. Believe in him and you will have life. And that's what Jesus is saying. Follow me and you will have life to the full. You will be fully alive. That's why I think the early church grew, why it turned the world upside down. It wasn't like Zacchaeus was told by Jesus, you know, I've done some tax calculations and you owe 50% of your income to the poor. And it's like, Zacchaeus is like, what can I give away? I don't need anything more. I have Jesus now. But Jesus didn't say to the woman at the well, you got to go confess your past to everybody or else I can't make it right. It doesn't matter because she's met Jesus. You have life in his name if you meet. And I wonder, see, I grew up with a very different evangelistic message. And it went something like this. Tim, you're a sinner, and without Jesus, you will go to hell. And if you die tonight, do you know where you're going? Repent, believe in Jesus, and then you will be saved from hell and go to heaven. Now, it worked. I'm here telling you about Jesus. And I believe everything I just said. That's a true statement, all of that. But I hope you're hearing a different invitation from Jesus and his disciple John through this gospel. Not a punishment hanging over your head about what God wants to do to you if you don't do the right things in your life. But Jesus saying to you, you have no idea how to party. You have no idea what celebration is. You have no idea what joy is like. You're chasing all kinds of things that you think will give you joy. None of it works. Only I work. Come to me and have life. And so people experienced that life and the dramatic followed because they were full of his life. And that's why conversion spread. And so I love the way that author Dallas Willard talks about this. He writes, he, Jesus, and his early associates overwhelmed the ancient world because they brought into it a stream of life at its deepest, along with the best information possible on the most important matters. These were matters with which the human mind had already been seriously struggling for a millennium or more without much success. The early message was, accordingly, not experienced as something its hearers had to believe or do because otherwise something bad, something with no essential connection with real life, would happen to them. The people initially impacted by that message generally concluded that they would be fools to disregard it. That was the basis of their conversion. So, question, is our church or is your life so pulsating with the life and joy of Jesus the Messiah that the people of Chesterton, LaPorte, Valpo, Michigan City, Porter, LaPorte County, Lake County would encounter us or you and say, look at that life. I would be a fool not to ask them, what table are you eating from? What well are you drinking from? Where are you getting this life from? I'd be a fool not to ask you that question. Does that happen to us? And I wonder sometimes if the reason why our evangelism strategies threaten people with hell is because we know the punishment and we fear it. But we don't yet know the life because we haven't tasted it. So we've gone to God to avoid punishment, but we've not gone to feast with the master of the party yet. And this morning, I want to say, let's do that. So that's the promise. Jesus doesn't say to you, listen, if you don't do what I say, bad things will happen to you. I mean, that's true. I don't deny that. What he is saying is, his invitation to you is, you have no idea how to live. Listen to my voice instead. So that's the promise first. Secondly, the threat to his promise then. So John 10 makes clear there are other voices out there, other voices saying to you, come this way, listen to me, come this way to have life. And we hear a couple of them. In verse 5 of chapter 10, we read this. But they, Jesus talking about his disciples here, they'll never follow a stranger. In fact, they will run away from the stranger because they do not recognize his voice. Or in verses 7 and 8, Jesus says, "Very truly I tell you, I am the gate for the sheep. All who have come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep have not listened to them. I am the gate, and whoever enters through me will be saved." So did you notice there are other voices who Jesus says are thieves and robbers who want to take from you and steal from you? So Jesus is saying is if you listen to the wrong voice, you will not have life. You'll be stolen from. Things will be taken from you. You will not be fully alive. So that there's many ways we could go down that road to apply that. And I'm just going to go down three roads briefly to talk about some of what I think Jesus means by this. What steals our joy from us, our life in Jesus' name from us? First is grief. Grief numbs us to life through pain. And so how can Jesus say, "I will give you life to the full" in this world? I mean, just in the text itself, in about 30 verses, Jesus is going to be dealing with the death of his good friend Lazarus. How can we live life to the full in a world full of death and suffering and sickness? Right now, like even in our church, we have several people who have just begun rounds of chemo who can't be here this morning. If they have the energy later today, they'll watch this sermon. And it's like what I'm saying just kind of cruel. Like, hey, you might be dying of cancer, but you can be fully alive in Jesus. Right? Is that just singing to our grave? So much of the passion, our life, the hope of what Jesus is saying here can die out because of the suffering and the wounds we experience in this life. As theologian Nicole Rokos says, she writes, "We cease caring once the act of caring wounds us or becomes too heavy a burden to bear." So how can Jesus ask us to be alive in a world where everything we love will die? And I wonder if that's sometimes why we try to tamp down the promise of Jesus. It's like, it's just not realistic, Jesus, not here. When heaven, yes, we can have life to the full then. But that's not what Jesus said. He didn't say, when you die, it'll get better for you. He said, no, I came that you may have life and have it to the full now, right now. Don't let grief numb you from that promise. But secondly, apathy numbs us to life through indifference. So in the 1990s, the most famous sitcom was Seinfeld. So famous that in 1998, during its finale, 76.3 million people watched it, the finale. The show was explicitly billed as a show about nothing. And Larry David, one of the creators of the show, said one of the show's mottos was "no hugging, no learning." The point being, the show's not going to have a moral at the end of the show. There's not going to be a story to it where there's redemptive arcs in characters. It's just a show about nothing. It's a full confession. I have laughed at the show of Seinfeld and find aspects of it hilarious. But I will also say, I think aspects of the show kind of takes a toll on our culture. And here's what theologian Uche Anitsour says about Seinfeld and its premise. He writes, "It was not a show about nothing per se, but a show about insignificant, petty things. It was a show that normalized indifference toward big, meaningful things, such as marriage, family, religion, social concern, even the Holocaust. And a fixation on life's daily minutiae, such as getting a good parking spot, the annoyance of close talkers, and maintaining one's high score in Frogger. Indifference was the name of the game." And so his point is that apathy is not necessarily not caring or not having passion. It can also be about caring about insignificant things. Things that don't really matter in the end. And so Jesus in John 10 says there are other voices. And they want you to follow them. Listen to them. And I want to submit to you that probably the loudest voice in our culture offering you life is the voice of apathy and distraction, and the insignificant. And that becomes the way many of us deal with our grief and our pain and our disappointments, is we care about the insignificant things. And listen, I understand that. I do that. And as a pastor, I'm regularly in touch with the most painful realities of human life. Divorce and death, broken family relationships, the amount of human suffering in this room alone is incalculable. And I don't know all the stories in this room. I only know those who've invited me or our church into those stories. I only see a fraction of the pain in this room. And so our large-scale cultural response has been apathy, distraction, devote ourselves to the trivial, live a numbed existence because we think that's the best that we can do. And so you look, we're a culture that argues about petty and insignificant things. And any of us who have been in the church more than a few years have seen the church argue about petty and insignificant things that we invest with eternal significance. Jesus is saying to us this morning, I can do better than that. You have to numb yourself out with distraction, with your Netflix cure, your phone. You don't have to devote your life to insignificant things. You don't have to look away from your grief and embrace apathy. Jesus is saying, I can make you fully alive again. I can fulfill every desire of your heart. You don't have to numb them anymore. So maybe you hear that and think, oh, okay, well, Tim, religion, that's what you want us to pursue. And no, religion is the third threat to becoming fully alive because religion numbs our life through duty. So again, verses 7 and 8, Jesus says, very truly I tell you, I'm the gate for the sheep. All who have come before me are thieves and robbers. So we should be asking, who are the thieves and robbers? Who is Jesus talking about? And it's important because it shows up three times in all of John 10. So if you read all of John 10, 1 to 18, you hear about the thieves and the robbers three times in the first 10 verses. It's in verse 1. Jesus says, you should enter by the gate, but someone who enters not by the gate is a thief and robber. That's 10 verse 1. There's verses 7 and 8, which I just read for you. And then it's again in verse 10. Jesus says, the thief comes only to steal and kill, destroy, but I've come that you may have life and life to the full. Who's he talking about? Who are the thieves and the robbers? And do you see, Jesus is contrasting himself as someone who has life to dispense to you, not as someone who wants to take from you. He wants to give, not take. But there are other people in the world, Jesus says, they want to take from you, not give. So who are they? Who are the thieves and robbers? Well, if you go back before John 10 and into John 9, what you'll find there is the healing of a blind man that sparks off a debate among the religious leaders. It ultimately culminates in the religious leaders treating the healed blind man really terribly. This is awful. It's like this guy's been blind for most of his life, and then he's healed, and the Pharisees are like, you're a terrible person, and they move on because he has faith in Jesus. But then if you keep reading from 9, it seems like John 9 probably goes right into John 10. And so Jesus is having this back and forth with these religious leaders, and it goes right into John 10, which is why most interpreters would say, well, John 10, the thieves and the robbers, they are the Pharisees. They're the religious establishment of Jesus' own day. Jesus is critiquing religion's way of approaching you with life. And so often we think about God, religion, the way Pastor John Tyson describes, which is this, that we think religion is duty to laws we don't want to keep. Zephyr, we talk in church about things God has told us to do. And so it can begin to be easy to think, oh, God's told me to do a bunch of things. I don't want to do them. He's withholding joy from me. I have to obey him, even though I don't want to do them. And there's two potential problems with that. The first is religion becomes a place where we think we earn God's approval through our keeping of his rules. And in religion like this, churches like this, there's always two types of people. First, the people who think they are keeping the rules and God approves of them because they are keeping the rule and they're not any fun to be around. So they think they're better than people. So they're not welcoming to new people to the church. They're not kind to others who are struggling with sin or brokenness. They're judgmental of others. They're always gossiping about other people behind their back because they're not as good as they think they are. So the church becomes a beige, passionless place through judgmental people. It's no fun. Or the other side is we know we're not keeping the rules, and so the church becomes a place of secret sin where we hide from one another because we think the teachings are an obstacle to our happiness. The teachings of Jesus are not the means to our life and joy. They're an obstacle. So we secretly sin because we want to be happy, and then we live in shame because of it. And so the church then becomes full of people either mired in shame or overbearing in pride. It's the problem with religion. And so Jesus is not saying, here are all my rules. If you keep them, then you'll have life. That's not what he's saying. But the other problem with religion, and this is what I think Jesus is getting at, is that religion or churches often have a skeptical eye towards desiring, towards passion. Right? That you shouldn't desire a deep connection with another person in marriage. And so sex is viewed with great suspicion. Or you shouldn't desire being someone who tries to do truly good work through your career or vocation. You only work so that you can give money to the church. You shouldn't desire a long afternoon at Wrigley Field or whatever the Southside ballpark is called. That was really bad. I'm sorry. It's still guaranteed rate field, right? I love you, Sox fans. You shouldn't desire a long afternoon of baseball, enjoying the beauty of baseball and a beverage. You should only care about spiritual things. I love the way the poet William Cooper talks about this, who himself actually struggled with great depression in his life, tried to commit suicide. But he also understood Jesus is not a religious teacher saying to you, stop desiring, keep the rules. Instead, Jesus is saying, you don't want enough. The desires you have, I can go way beyond that. And so William Cooper wrote this in his poetry. Hath God indeed given appetites to men and stored the earth so plenteously with means to gratify the hunger of his wish? And doth he reprobate and will he damn the use of his own bounty? And this is Old English, so that may have just gone right over your head. That's okay. But what he's saying is, just look around at the earth. It's beauty, the joys available to you. Do you think God put all of that there to say to you, don't you do that? No. So Cooper continues, so frail a kind, human beings, we're frail, so frail a kind, and then enacting laws so strict that less than perfect must despair? Falsehood, which whoso but suspects of truth, dishonors God and makes a slave of man. What he means, if you look at this world, all of its joys, what's available to you, and you make up a bunch of rules God never said, and say to others, don't drink that, don't touch that, don't do that. And God never said those things. You're dishonoring God, and you're making slaves of human beings. And that's what religion does. Looks at our desires and passions with skepticism, says, dial it all back, tone it down, you're meant to be miserable, then you'll go to heaven. And Jesus says, no. And John, his disciple, says, no. Come drink from his well. Come eat from his you'll never hunger or thirst again. And so, point three, what do I mean by all this? What are we doing? How do we become fully alive? Well, this is the beginning of 5 weeks together. And this is week one of a vision series. And so I've spent about 9-10 months gathering all kinds of different people from our church, all campuses, and asking two questions. Question one is, what do you hope never changes about Liberty Bible Church? And question two, who is best embodied who we should be as a church? And so over the next 5 weeks, what we're going to do is lay out a vision of who we want to be as a church together moving forward, creating new vision and value statements around how you answered those questions and my best attempt to translate those and connect those to the scriptures and those values we want to drive who we are as a church, what has made Liberty a place that's existed for 100 years. And I know that can all sound boring and like church speak. I get that. I hope it's not. But this morning, what I want to propose to you is what I believe should be our orienting vision statement as a church. Why we exist. Why we should do this together. Because as I gathered all of those groups together, which was student ministries, cross campuses. I don't know if you know, we call our the senior ministry the fourth quarter ministry. But this week I talked to some of them and they're like, that kind of sounds like the game's almost over. It's kind of dark. So they were like, we might change it to the speeders. Because we're all over 55, which I like that. It's my kind of people right there. But as I gathered all those people, by far the most energizing parts of those questions is when we ask the question, who has best embodied who we should be as a church? Tell us those stories. Man, those people, there have been some people who have come through this church. By far the most mentioned person was Al Marquez. A pastor here who would share Jesus anytime, anywhere, with anyone. By far the second most mentioned person, I haven't seen her yet. She's in the room probably. There you are. Sorry, Betty. They mentioned you. Wasn't me. It was everyone else who mentioned Betty Strolnick. She's over 55. She's a speeder. That's all we'll say. But praise with our teenagers often on Sunday mornings. Can I just, when I get to that age in church, I know I'm going to hate the music. I'm probably not going to like the preaching. I'm just plug my ears and I'm like, I'm with you guys. I don't care. I'm here for others at that point. And Betty has embodied that. And teenagers know Jesus through her life. Or think about the people who started what was a Sunday school that became Liberty Bible Church 100 years ago, or almost 100 years ago. They did not start a Sunday school because they thought kids need good moral instruction. They did not start a Sunday school because they thought the Bible is interesting. We should give more Bible facts to kids. They didn't start a Sunday school because they thought we need more well-behaved kids in Chesterton. Everyone's well-behaved in Valpo. Let's get to Chesterton and straighten them up. Right? None of that is going to make you have a vision of life that's going to make you give significant financial resources, significant time and passion to other people. None of that is life. Rather, I want to submit to you, the people who started that Sunday school almost 100 years ago knew the life and joy of Jesus Christ. They were fully alive. So it was not a burden for them to give time, money, and their life. And 100 years later, here we are. And so, my friends, my submission to you, what should our vision as a church be? To continue what was started 100 years ago. Why do we do this together? And it's, for me, it's this. We exist as a church that all people might be fully alive in the kingdom of God. Fully alive. Not ignoring the grief or pain of this life. Not apathetic, caring about insignificant things. Not lost in religious rules and expectations we've made up that are far from the words and teachings of Jesus. No, lost in the fullness of life he promised us. That when he said, I have bread that will satisfy you forever. I have drink. That he wasn't lying. He was making a promise to you. So let's eat from his table and drink from his cup. And so we're going to talk a lot about that over the next few weeks. And honestly, for the rest of the time that I'm here, certainly. But in the years to come. But I want to start with two thoughts briefly this morning about what I have as hopes for our own community. The first is that we will be a community that runs toward the voice of Jesus and away from every other voice. Just one question. I'm about 20 years into ministry at this point, and the thing that continues to surprise me is how many Christians disagree with Jesus' teachings and build their life on that disagreement. Where Jesus has said something like so clearly, and then we do the opposite and think no big deal. And I just want to say, when a voice that is counter to the teachings of Jesus speaks, do you run the other direction? Not walk, run the other direction. When a voice says, hey, you need to dwell on that bitterness, don't forgive that person. Are you sprinting out of that conversation or that voice? When a voice encourages you and says, listen, you cannot be radically generous with your time or with your money, are you running the other way from that voice? When you begin to hear someone tear another Christian down in negativity and unhelpfulness, are you running out of that conversation? Because there's no life with that voice. There is life in the voice of Jesus. Or maybe, and it's okay if this is where you are. It's like, oh, I'm brand new. Like, what does Jesus even say? I don't think I know. That's okay. And I have good news for you, because 2025 is going to be the year of Jesus here, listening to his teachings. And so the primary two sermon series for the rest of this year is going to be John 13 through 17 from March to August, his final words to the disciples in the upper room, and then Matthew 5 to 7, the Sermon on the Mount from September to November. And the reason for this is not because Jesus gave you a bunch of rules that no one wants to keep, and he wants you to be unhappy and miserable. Then you get to heaven and it'll all get better after that. No, it's because he wants you to be fully alive. And he was fully alive. Loving his enemies, giving himself away to whoever he encountered, speaking words of kindness over broken, hurting people, confronting the thieves and the robbers and saying, you're not stealing from these people anymore. I've come to stand between you and them. This guy was full of life and can satisfy the desires of all of your heart. And listen, I realize maybe you're in some of it's like, is this prosperity gospel? Is this like, what do you mean by this? And just let's go to Psalm 37 really quick. Let God speak for himself. And this is what God says, Psalm 37, verse 4. Take delight in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Now, I know I have all kinds of desires in my heart that are not helpful to me. I don't know what they are and what they aren't. What I do know is when I come to God, I don't come to a God saying, dial it back, shh. It's like, you don't even know the half of what you want, Tim. And I have it for you. So that's first. We're going to sit in Jesus' teachings this year. Second, we know life is in Jesus and not the things of Jesus. So I'm not saying we come to Jesus to get things from him. So we come to Jesus to get him and with him comes all things. So there's a famous Greek myth. It's about Ulysses, who had to sail past the island with sirens. And what happened is you sail past the sirens, they would play their music, play a song, and they sang so beautifully that you'd want to follow them in their direction. And as you did, you followed them to your own destruction. They were singing that song to destroy you, to steal from you, to take from you. So I don't know if you know this, the Starbucks logo is the siren from that myth. This time you drive by Starbucks, just think, this is leading me to my own personal destruction. I only kind of meant that. And so here's what Ulysses did. He said, I have to hear that song, but I don't want it to be destroyed. So he said to his shipmates, here's what you're going to do. You're going to plug your ears with wax, and you're going to tie me to the mast. And no matter what I say, you do not let me go. And then you sail right past that island so I can hear their song. And so we get, that's what it is. As Ulysses tied to the mast, hearing the song. Which I think is a lot of Christian vision for life. We look at the world and we know the world's desires will destroy us, but we want to hear them anyway. So we get as close as we can, but tie us down and we'll make it just barely into heaven. And we look at the world, its desires, and we think, oh, I want them, but I know I shouldn't, so just tie me to the mast. I just want to say to you this morning, there's another way. The Greek myth continues with someone named Jason, who knew the siren song, but rather than say, tie me to the mast, what he did was find me the best musician in the world, a guy named Orpheus. And he said to Orpheus, when we get to that island with the sirens, you play me a song so beautiful, I don't care what they sing over me. And that, church, is our way forward. Hearing the voice of Jesus, singing and speaking life over us, that we're not gripped to the mast, restrained, barely making it to heaven. But who cares about the sirens when we have the Son of God, the Messiah, speaking over us life to the full for all eternity? Can you hear the voice of Jesus this morning? What he says later in John 10 is this: I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The hired hand is not the shepherd. So when the hired hand sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. You know, a lot of the things we invest our lives and joy and happiness into, the moment we need them, they're gone. Money, relationships, your career, all of that, all of those things are good things, but when they become the voice that's guiding our life, the moment we need them, they run away. Jesus says, on the other hand, I will never run away from you. I don't care what threatens your joy. I don't care what threatens your life. I'm here in the boat with you, singing over you till we get to safe shores. And so Jesus goes on, the words I started this service with. The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. And so do you hear what Jesus is saying to you this morning? I'm so committed to your life that you would be fully alive, that you could eat from his table and drink from his well. He'll lay his life down for you. What a song. What a voice. And what siren song could this world give you that's better than that? And so, church, may you tune our voice to the song and voice of Jesus and become fully alive with him.
Thanks for being with us today. If you'd like more information on our church or a place to connect, you can check us out on the web at findliberty.net.